What is up, ladies and gentlemen? Welcome to episode 71 of Star Wars Beneath Twin Suns, a massive breakdown podcast. We're coming to you on a Sunday evening, actually a very rainy day out here in Florida, but still a wonderful Sunday evening nonetheless, because we get to talk about Star Wars. We get to talk about the Bad Batch. We are going to be talking about two episodes, Entombed and Tribe. And these episodes are kind of where I feel like the show started to find its footing. Not so much with Entombed. But Tribe was an episode that I watched and I was like, oh, all right, here we go. And pretty much from there out, most of the episodes were pretty high quality. So excited to get to talking about these. As always, let's get started with the introductions. My name is Mercules, joined today by Kit Kutcher. And how are you doing this fine Sunday, Kit?
Well, I'm very excited to have survived a weekend full of children's birthday parties and end of school year activities and other things that happen when you're a parent. I've definitely eaten a lot more junk food than I usually do. And it's one of those things, you know, when you're used to eating junk food, like, I guess you don't notice how it affects your energy and the way you feel, but I am not used to eating junk food. And I feel like kind of garbage. But I can put all that aside. I've got a nice healthy protein shake and some water to reset my biology here. Maybe go have a nice back to soak later, you know. And I'm ready to escape from bounce houses and Nerf guns and start talking about blasters and hyperspace. How are you doing, man?
While you've got a healthy protein shake and a water, I've got myself a bullet rye whiskey on the rocks, and I've got myself a Mexican Coke. The two are not mixed. The Mexican Coke is, of course, the Coke made with sugarcane and in a glass bottle, which is very nice. So I will be doing the opposite of resetting my body to a healthier state, and I will instead be partaking in a couple of vices and alcohol and soda while we talk about Star Wars. So
yeah, most Sundays I'd be happy to join you in that, but I don't think today. I think today if I did that, at some point y'all would hear my head hit my keyboard. It would be a different kind of show.
Yeah, this is Star Wars Beneath Twin Suns. This isn't Star Wars Beneath Twin Suns After Dark.
Yeah,
which is the adult version of this show where we're both hammered and we just complain about the Star Wars community and the sequels. And that's a very different show.
Yeah. Now we complain about the Star Wars community like the Star Wars community complains about Star Wars. Yeah. No. This should be good then. This should be good. I think you're right. I think, you know, we kind of had a bit of a rough start to season two of The Bad Batch. And slowly we get a little bit of hope. You know, there are still some episodes that are going to be airing a little closer to a 5 than a 10 to come here. But, you know, there's a lot to like in these two episodes.
Yeah, Entombed, I think the community has decided that Entombed was the worst episode of this season. I didn't dislike it. I didn't dislike it as a whole. I think an argument could be made that it is maybe the second weakest episode of season two, behind Faster. I didn't find a ton to enjoy about Faster. Entombed, I found a little bit more to enjoy, but it also, you know, it suffers from a lot of the same things that Faster did, where it doesn't really feel like, it doesn't really feel like the world building, you know, it sacrifices the main story for world building. We've talked about that. And for the most part, I think you and I are on the same page that we can be amenable to that, right? We don't require the main story to move forward every time, as long as the world building that's being done is worthwhile, right? And in Faster, I didn't feel like the world building was super great. In this, it's a little bit better. And the references it makes, the, you know, the throwbacks, kind of what it's angling for is like an Indiana Jones style adventure. It was something I was able to get on board with. You know, I don't even mind Fee as a character. I think Wanda Sykes does a pretty all right job with her. You know, she's, for what she is, you know, that archetypal character, she's all right. So I didn't even really mind that. And I thought the reveal at the end was a little bit out of left field, but I kind of enjoyed that too, to be totally honest, right? So, like, I didn't have a big issue with this episode. But at the same time, I wasn't enthralled with it. You know, I wasn't head over heels in love with the episode either. I felt like, you know, there's only so much world building you can do from inside of a melon.
So, by and large, I agree. You know, I like the fact that they're sort of talking about how old the Star Wars galaxy is and how many civilizations have risen and fallen in that history. And what I would have liked is some indication that this story would lead to other stories in the future. Some sort of, even if it never did, right? Even if they were just like, maybe this is something we'll revisit, right? If they just gave us some hint. But it didn't feel like that. It felt like they were sort of closing off that bit. And now maybe, you know, maybe someday Filoni comes back and we find out more about, you know, who built these wacky temples and machines and all of this. I think that'd be very interesting. I think there's room in the Star Wars universe for a treasure hunting type of series. I think that could be a really great Star Wars avenue to explore, something that's sort of hinted at in a lot of the existing Star Wars lore, but it's not a path that's ever really been gone down, right? It's sort of the treasure hunting that happens is always sort of on the way to somewhere else. What it says is like, hey, there's a ton of ancient history and ancient technology and weird stuff that's happened over the last 20,000 years in this galaxy, and a lot of it's just laying around because people have forgotten about it. And like, I'm like, there's a whole like huge story that you can tell there, right? There's, you know, you got a whole serial right there, 10 seasons of adventures, easy. But that's not this show, at least not right now. And it felt weird to me that like they would like start to tell this story and then kind of leave it like they're gonna like close it off, and it didn't feel like they were setting up the future. It felt like they were just having a side quest.
Yeah, you know, it's some of the same.
That's my impression.
Some of the same consternations that people kind of had with season 3 of The Mandalorian, where it feels like they're, you know, they're trying different things. They were like, this is a CSI episode of Mandalorian. And in this one, they're like, this is an Indiana Jones episode of Bad Batch. And I enjoy the Indiana Jones stuff. But, you know, at this point in time in the season, my patience is wearing a bit thin. You know, we've had one really good episode, one not so great episode, and you know, an intro to the season that I was a little bit disappointed with, considering where season one ended. So it's, you know, it did some all right stuff, but I'm starting to get a little bit like, do they not know where they're going? Like, that's what I remember watching. Mm-hmm. I remember watching this and being like, do they not know where they're going? Like, the flavor of the week stuff works if you have an overarching story that like frames it, right? Like the Mandalorian going off and doing a CSI thing works because there's an overarching story that's being told, and you know that they're going to get back to it, and it's going to be good, and it's going to be fine, and they're going to wrap it up. The Bad Batch at this point in time doesn't seem to have an overarching story. So the flavor of the week stuff, you know, I lose patience with it just a tiny bit, because I'm like, where is this supposed to be going? Like, I am willing to take a departure if I know that there's something that's going to happen long term.
Right.
Or if it's framed appropriately and like, this is where they started, this is where they're going to. In between, they do some side quests. I think that's fun. Video games are designed like that. I think those are fun. But in this is where they're started. I have no idea where they're going to. And I don't think they have any idea where they're going to either. And at this point in time, I was like, the writers don't seem to have any idea where they're going to. Because they're just like, they're just throwing stuff at the wall. Like, they did a pod racing episode last week, and now they're doing an Indiana Jones episode. And, you know, I was like, all right, you know, I'm starting to lose patience a little bit because I want to understand what's happening. Or I want to understand, like, okay, well, the Bad Batch are just going to be, you know, they're going to be the titular characters, but we're actually going to be telling a story of the wider universe, in which case, fine, like, let's do that. But I would much rather see characters that aren't the Bad Batch doing the Indiana Jones stuff than I would see the Bad Batch doing it, because it just, you know, it just seemed a little bit weird, a little bit out of place. But,
you know, I think that they could make some great, you know, Tomb Raiders, Dungeoneers, what have you. But I feel like there would need to be like a clear and like well set up like transitions, like that being what the show becomes about, right. Not just like, well, this week this is what we're doing, which is sort of how it came off. You know, it felt kind of out of left field to me.
Yeah, I was thinking about this the other day, and I was like, why did the A-Team work with this like villain of the week type thing? And the Bad Batch doesn't really seem to work that way. And the conclusion that I came to when I was thinking about this is because of what's happening in the wider universe. At the same time the Bad Batch exists, it's impossible to just do like a flavor of the week thing. Like, you can't do a flavor of the week when huge pivotal changes are taking place in the galaxy at the exact same time. You just can't do it, right? Like, the only way you could do a villain of the week, a flavor of the week type thing, is if you were in some, doesn't necessarily need to be like an obscure period, but some period of like general stability, or some period that is like not associated with the rise of the Empire, right? You could even probably do it in the around the Andor time period, right? Where like the Empire has been in power for a long time, and they are the, like, they are the consistent bad guy. Like, they're the Nazis to Indiana Jones's adventure, mm-hmm. right? Where, like, they're just the omnipresent bad guy, right? But that's when everything is already stabilized, when the Empire has been in power for a long time. You could do a flavor of the week then. I think it's really, really hard to do a flavor of the week right at the beginning of the Empire's rise, because there's so much stuff that's in flux. There's so much stuff that's changing. Everything is in motion, right? And so when that stuff is happening beside the main story, that's such a huge pivotal change in Star Wars' universe that my attention keeps getting drawn over to that. Like, I want to know more about that. That's why I like the Solitary Clone. That's why I like the episodes later on in this season that deal with the clones, that deal with the Senate, that deal with political intrigue. Like, that's why I'm so interested in that stuff. And it's splitting my attention away from the Bad Batch and their like flavor of the week type thing that they've got going on. Because to be quite honest, like, what the Bad Batch is doing isn't super interesting compared to what is happening elsewhere at the same time. And that's not the Bad Batch's fault. That's just, you know, that's just how the story ended up being told. But that was the conclusion that I came to, because I'm a big fan of villain of the week serialized type stuff, right? Like, I love Star Trek The Next Generation. I love Strange New Worlds, which is a new Star Trek that's very similar in that. Like, I like that type of thing. But I don't like it when there's something going on alongside it that we don't necessarily know a ton about, because we haven't gotten a lot of media from that time, right? Like, we haven't had a ton of Empire Rises media. We have a lot of, like, right before Return of the Jedi, or sorry, right before A New Hope, and we have a lot of, like, prequel era stuff, but we don't have a lot of the kind of in-between, short of Rebels, which Rebels is, again, like, closer to the end of that period of time.
Yeah. Yeah. Closer to and then during. So, yeah, I see where you're going with this. And I think part of the, like, one of the things that makes shows like that work, like, for me, you know, like, the one I would kind of draw on is, like, you know, watching things like the old, like, Batman animated series, right? There's a status quo that we return to at the end of the villain of the week situation. Right. And so when you've got a, you know, it's, there's sort of like, there's the way that things are, and then someone new comes in and changes things for the worse. And then the heroes have to resolve that issue. And then at the end, we return the status quo. But in this series, maintaining the status quo feels like, it feels wrong, because the greater universe is not in a period of status quo. It's in a period of flux, like you said. And so we know the Empire is, you know, its influence is encroaching constantly. And so when that doesn't seem to affect the Bad Batch, it feels like there's a discordance between what their experience is and what we feel like it should be. Like, they should, we feel like they should constantly be having to move around and do things to avoid, but they found this new status quo hanging out with Cid. And it doesn't feel like it's threatened on a regular basis. It doesn't feel like they're having to take steps to protect it. Or even their identities, really. Like, they're always going around in their very identifiable clone armor. And so it feels a bit discordant that they're sort of, you know, telling stories like that. And no one's like, oh, hey, a bunch of rogue clones running around. I wonder if the Empire would be interested in them. I am like, you know, like in Faster, like it's like we've got a crime lord and he's like, he doesn't stop to be like, hey, who are these guys? Where are they from? And is the Empire interested in collecting a bounty on them? Because I'm interested in getting paid. Like, never comes up. And it just feels weird that that stuff isn't a if that stuff was always happening to them and that's what the show was about, it'd be super interesting because they would have to grow and change as characters. There would constantly be threats. You know, they'd be moving around. Then they could do world building by going each time, you know, every couple of weeks they move to a new place and try to establish a new status quo. And then it gets upset and they move along. But that's not where we're at this point in the season, right? Up to this point, the old status quo that, you know, they found hanging out at Cid's bar and getting jobs from Cid and this sort of, like, uneasy truce between them is still hanging on and it feels, I don't know, like, it feels not interesting, like you said, because we've got all of this other stuff going on in the Star Wars universe.
Season one ends with a huge pivotal event and the destruction of Kamino.
Yeah. Right?
And you're like, oh shit, like now things are going to be different. But then season two starts and they're not different. It's just the same. It's like Kamino was destroyed and this huge pivotal thing happened. And they're just like, all right, back to the status quo. And you're like, wait, but no, like you shouldn't revert to the status quo. Like the status quo is before the giant pivotal thing happens. Right. I don't know if you've read like the Aragon books, where the like farm boy gets a dragon and stuff like that.
Yes.
And
like, it would be like classic.
The farm boy getting a dragon and the dragon like flies away and he's like, oh, well that was neat. Like guess back to being a farm boy then. And you're just like, what? No, like there's a dragon, like go after the dragon, like go do the thing. Right. It would be like that. And, or it'd be like, you know, Frodo getting the ring and then like being like, oh, well, you know, that was awesome. Like puts the ring in a jewelry drawer and just like goes on about his life. You're like, what? No, like you go on the adventure, like do the thing. But like they went and, you know, rescued Omega and Kamino was destroyed and they lost Crosshair. And then they're just like, all right, cool. Well, I guess back to, you know, back to running errands for Cid.
Yeah. Like,
it's like, well, hold on now. I feel like something really major happened to y'all. And you're just like, nah, that's fine. I don't need to pay attention to it. So, you know, we've talked about it, but it felt like a reversion. Like you said, it was a return to the status quo, and there's a time and a place for that. But it's not when the huge pivotal thing is still ongoing and still happening. It's when it's done. And they're done with this adventure, and they retire. Then they return to the status quo, right? Like, after you've overthrown the evil warlord, and you've, you know, slayed the bad dragon, then you go back to the farm, right? And, you know, Frodo doesn't return to the Shire 4 minutes after getting the ring. He goes on a whole adventure, then he returns to the Shire. Changed.
I think the analogy is, it's like, you know, Frodo gets the ring and Gandalf, you know, tells him he's got to run and you know, he goes and they're chased by the Black Riders and they get to, you know, they get to Elrond's house and they're like, oh man, that was crazy. And then like, they're like, well, good luck. And they just leave the ring and they just go like, we're going back to the Shire. We got turnips to pick or something.
Yeah.
You know, so like that's what? Okay, well, I guess the hobbits aren't part of the story now. Let's follow Elrond. But instead we're following the hobbits.
Yeah. What it seemed like to me is they like surprised themselves with the destruction of Kamino. And they were like, oh, wow, that was like a huge deal that we just did that. Where do we go from there? No idea. Like, let's throw some darts at the wall and let's pick up on one that seems fun. And so this, like, Entombed is the last of the episodes where I feel like they were, like, really just throwing darts at a wall. Faster was one, Entombed was one. So we can start talking about. So We start off in a junkyard. They're looking for a compressor, which interestingly enough was the same part that I guess had been stolen out of the Millennium Falcon in The Force Awakens.
Right.
So Wrecker finds a compressor from an old, the wreckage of a LAAT gunship, while Omega finds like an oval and ball shaped object. Omega's basically just like gathering junk is what it seems like for the most part, which I don't blame her for. She's a kid. She's just collecting. Meanwhile, you know, Fee is telling a tale, maybe a tall tale, about fighting an octomorph to recover the Grand Pearl of Novak to, you know, an Athorian in a weak way in Sid's bar. And then Echo, Hunter, and Tech. And as Tech points out, he's like, you know, this story gets different. Every time she tells it, the story changes just a little bit, right? But Hunter points out that, you know, Bolo and Ketch, which are the names of the Athorian and the Weequay, is like, they'll pretty much believe anything. They're pretty gullible. So Wrecker and Omega kind of show back up. Wrecker with the compressor, Omega with all of her relics. Tech is like, this is all junk. Why did you bring any of this stuff back? But Fee recognizes one of the relics as some sort of, you know, stellar compass with coordinate markings on it. And she says the coordinates are for the Kaldar Trinary System, which Tech, you know, in all his infinite wisdom, just basically knows that the system is uncharted. And Fee's like, well, you know, that's kind of the way all the best treasures work, right? If all the best treasures were charted on maps, people would find them and they wouldn't, they'd be gone. So all the best treasures are kind of uncharted. And thus begins our treasure hunt.
Yeah.
Or begins our treasure hunt after a little bit of typical Hunter being like, no, this is a waste of time. We shouldn't do this. And then getting convinced by Omega basically being like, but I want to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Pretty standard back and forth between the two of them. That just feels like a foregone conclusion. To some extent, I'm kind of like, yeah, Hunter's probably right. Sounds like it is probably a dangerous waste of time. I will end up doing nothing but costing you fuel. But, you know, go on. So, so they decide to go and do it. You know, Echo's not super excited either. He's like, our last treasure hunt didn't exactly go off without a hitch. Obviously being the Castle Sereno debacle from the first episodes. But Fee, you know, is like, oh, I'm a professional treasure hunter, you know, so you'll be in good hands here. And so they end up going along. They travel aboard the Marauder, and Omega is just sort of hanging on Fee's every word. You know, sort of despite the comments made by some of the others about how incredulous some of her stories are, Omega doesn't care. I think, you know, she's a little star for entertainment, if we're being honest.
Well, and it's like anti-Fee, right? Like, she just comes in, she's the adventurous, you know, aunt that just shows right up and, you know, regales the child with tall tales of various adventures. And, you know, a kid's a kid, right? Kid's just hanging on every word. So I think Hunter at one point calls her a pirate.
Yeah.
She's like, I'm not a pirate. I'm a liberator of ancient treasures.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's probably true, right? She's not like hijacking people's ships and stealing stuff from them. She's, you know, she's not a pirate the same way Indiana Jones isn't really a pirate.
The same way that Hondo's not a pirate.
Right. Man, this would have been a perfect thing for Hondo to be in here. I would have, nothing against Wanda Sykes and Fee, but I would have enjoyed this story a lot more if Hondo was the one taking them on the treasure hunt as opposed to...
Just for the nostalgia, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we've got more tall tales from Fee throwing out more names of places and objects that, you know, may or may not ever be explored elsewhere. They arrive at their destination, a entirely like devastated and lifeless world. Just the surface is just like barren, charred vegetation everywhere. But they're apparently on the right track because the compass starts buzzing at them, and they follow off, you know, in the direction indicated. Coordinates lead them through an old, like the remains of an old forest. and they come to like basically blank rock at the side of a mountain. And you know, the Lord of the Rings analogies are feeling more and more apt. I was waiting for somebody to try saying friend to get the mound to open, but nobody did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean this whole thing, like Scar and all, I was interested in that. Like the idea of like showing up on a world that's already just been totally desecrated, seemingly no living beings around, like something clearly cataclysmic has happened here. And so I was interested in that. Because like to me that's an idea, you know, that piqued my interest a little bit. You know, they kind of dead end at a mountain, which Omega thinks that the thing they need to do is go around, but Fee, being the experienced treasure hunter that she is like, no, we need to go through it. So they're, you know, with Wrecker's help, they're able to kind of discover the secret entrance. Of course, there's like some sort of creature, because of course there has to be, right? Like you have to get the shot of the like creature watching them, you know, enter into the tomb,
right?
But they discover some etchings. You know, Fee recognizes them somehow as the entrance to Scar and all. And I, you know, part of me was like, how could you possibly know that given what all this is, right? Like, but at the same time, it's like, how does Indiana Jones ever know any of the stuff that he knows, right? Like, it's, you don't think to, it's not that kind of movie, kid, right? As Harrison Ford would say.
Yeah.
To Luke Skywalker. It's not that kind of movie.
Yeah.
She kind of explains it a little bit, right? The legend of Scar and all predates the Jedi, and there's a treasure known as the Heart of the Mountain.
Allegedly, yes. Yeah, I think she says, like, every pirate out there has heard the legend of Scar and all. You know, it traces back to the Ancients, which is a group that predates the Jedi Order and the Galactic Republic. That's more or less, like, really all we get here. Ancients being a very apt name, turns out.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it is what it is. They have to solve like a puzzle, right? Like this reminded me a lot of like Jedi Fallen Order, and what little I have played through that game. You like get into a tomb, an ancient abandoned tomb. You have to like solve a puzzle to figure out how to move yourself forward, which in my mind was just intensely frustrating, and I didn't enjoy it very much. And that kind of led to me, you know, that along with the gameplay kind of led to me dropping the game. But it reminded me a lot of that, right? Like there's, you know, there's
you just lost
these
half
beams.
Our listeners right there, man. Jeez.
Yeah, I know. One day I'll go back through it. We were talking to Irresolute about this the other day. But it's like one day I will go back through and I will play Jedi Fallen Order and Jedi Survivor. I've continually hear incredible things about them, but the Souls gameplay just turns me off of it. But anyways, they basically need to align these symbols in the correct order. There's these beams that allow them to, you know, I don't know, move the floor or something. It's, you know, it's just a very typical like puzzle. But of course, what happens is they get trapped inside by a falling rock, and then I think, what is it, they use the compass, they like shine a light through the compass and it illuminates some of the symbols,
right?
And somehow, and that's how you know which ones you need to get them aligned.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Omega figures it out. You know, in one of those rare moments where she really contributes to the group's success in a meaningful way. You know, they hold the compass up to Fee's lamp, and then everyone can see which symbols need to match up. They, you know, manage to align them up and open a doorway. And then they proceed on in. You know, Fee explains that the Heart of the Mountain is like this rare crystal that's supposedly the key to some kind of ancient power. Tech actually is starting to become convinced. Finally here, he's, you know, of course doing like some sort of spectral analysis with his not tricorder, on the stone, and, determines that this, you know, does in fact predate the Empire, or the Republic, I mean. And, you know, things are kind of looking up. They're making progress. And, of course, that's when we get the jump scare. Fortunately, the monster goes after Wrecker first. the only one that it really makes sense would survive outright a fight like that. But they managed to drive off the monster. However, a bunch of rocks get knocked down. You know, there's a bit of a cave-in. They get separated. And they don't think they're going to be able to get through the rock fall. I just want to say, I like the puzzles in Fallen Order. Do they make any kind of, like, real logical sense in terms of existing in the world? Not particularly. But I find those to be pretty fun. Admittedly, I am also playing the game on story mode because I also am not a Dark Souls gamer. Like, I just don't enjoy that gameplay. And it is, it's real fun on story mode. When you're, it's very hard to lose a fight.
But yeah.
Anyways.
I mean, this is all fine. Yeah, this is all fine, right? Like, I don't know. I kind of wish that they had, like, I kind of wish that Fee had seen the compass and been like, that's one of the legendary compasses to take you to the heart of the thing. Like, it's weird to me that she doesn't know what the compass is, but as soon as they end up in the place, she sees these weird markings and she's like, oh, this is, you know, the Legend of Scar and all. Like, I kind of wish that that had been addressed earlier. I think maybe it would have piqued my interest earlier if she had been like, oh, this is a compass that, you know, refers to the Legend of Scar and all. And then it would have made more sense for them to, like, expect what they received on the other end of it, as opposed to them just, like, running off willy-nilly, her being like, this is a compass that leads to a treasure, and not having any idea what the treasure is.
Right.
And then getting there and seeing some weird etchings in the wall and being like, oh yeah, this is Scar and all. It's like, how could you possibly know that? But, you know, that it doesn't bother me. So they get, you know, they get split up because
it
they
bothers
have
you
to,
a little.
Because that's it bothers me a little. That's the way it works. you know, they, I think Fee keeps telling stories to, Omega.
Mm-hmm.
And she does mention something. She's like, this reminds me of my quest to track down the Belmont Diadem. So Belmont, hilariously enough, I am 99% sure is a reference to the villain in Indiana Jones. The French guy, his name is Belmond. With a D and not a T. Right? But I am 99% sure that that's a reference to that character, which I did think was pretty funny. So Omega realizes that the compass is able to unlock the door, which causes, you know, the tunnel to rotate and form a bridge, and can't get the compass, you know, back out. And Fee's like, well, Scar and all has reclaimed it. And I think Hunter just complains about the fact that, like, well, we've lost our only means of navigation through this thing. So sure. You know, on the other side, Tech is finding that his scanner is not working exactly the way he would expect it to. Wrecker's a little bit paranoid, since I guess anybody being grabbed by a giant fang beast and then dropped would make anyone a little bit skittish. But pretty soon they're able to just, like, kind of reunite with Omega Hunter and Fee. They don't really make a deal about it. They're basically only separated for like 5 minutes during this episode.
Yeah.
Right. And I'm like, why even bother to separate them at that point in time, right?
Yeah, it felt sort of odd that they were kind of reunited almost immediately. But ultimately, it's not something where I'm like going to get, you know, I'm not like, oh, this is terrible writing. It's just like, oh, okay, well, I guess they're back together.
I guess that didn't really matter then. Return to the status quo quickly, back to the status quo.
It felt to me like, you know, so I'm a big, like, tabletop RPG gamer. And so, like, you know, I've run a lot of games in the past. And it's like one of those moments where, like, the players do something stupid and, like, end up, like, the way it plays out is, like, you sort of end up, like, accidentally splitting up the party. And if you're running a game in person with people, like, having to take time to, like, okay, what are you guys doing over here? And then, and then this other place, what are you guys doing? It really gets, like, less fun because you've got people sitting around not participating in the action, which is the the whole point of playing a face-to-face game like that is that everyone's participating together. And so you're just like, all right, well, there's a side tunnel and it leads you right back to the main group. Oh, we've reunited the party.
Hooray, everyone's yes, happy. We're all back together.
Yes. Splitting the party, yeah. Man. It's the cardinal sin of tabletop role-playing. And that's the first thing I thought of when this happened. Like when they rejoined, I was like, oh, they realized that they had split the party and they didn't want to do that.
I buy that. So, anyways, they find the vault, you know, the treasure vault. There's a nice like shot for shot remake of the scene in Indiana Jones where he swaps out the temple idol for a bag of sand. It's like basically a shot to shot remake, even Omega's in the back.
Yeah.
And Fee, you know, steals the diamond or the crystal or whatever it is. But of course that triggers the structure's security mechanisms that seal all the entrances. Outside, the mountain just like splits apart and a beam of energy shoots out of it. And this giant machine emerges from the mountain. And this, I was like, you know what? This thing's cool as shit. I'll give him that. I was like, I don't understand it. This doesn't make any sense to me at all. But the machine that comes out of the mountain is pretty badass looking. And this also reminded me of like the bad machines that you constantly have to fight in Fallen Order. Like there are literally machines that look like this. You know, they're bipedal instead of, you know, more animalistic like this. But they've got the same like saucer shaped head and like laser beam eyes, and like the construction is very similar. So it reminded me a lot of that. So I don't know if that connection was, you know, designed that way, but to me it seemed like it was.
Yeah. I don't know if there's supposed to be like a reference or a connection there or not, but I can definitely see maybe drawing that line. I don't know. I haven't finished the game either, so not sure. Maybe I'd learn something later that would suggest a connection, but I will say that is like the visuals of the machine breaking free are easily the coolest part of this episode. And honestly, a big part of, I think, what makes everything that leads up to it worthwhile. That's the whole payoff for me, is like we get this awesome ancient war machine that just crashes out of the mountain.
So turns out that the heart of the mountain was actually, I guess, like a key that triggers this giant war machine to walk around, which I guess this is the explanation of how the planet became desecrated like this, is this giant freaking war machine went everywhere and blasted everything. But, you know, they're trying to convince Fee to put the heart of the mountain back because they think that'll deactivate the machine. But of course the fanged beast comes back in and attacks again. And there's just like, you know, a whole thing that I found tolerable, but not much else more than that. And poor little Mel, freaking Fee's little droid, tries to escape and just gets incinerated, which actually made me laugh. It's not like it's really funny, but it actually kind of made me laugh a little.
The most casual destruction. That poor droid. You're just like, oh.
Yeah, they blast open one of the windows, which are like the thing's eyes, and they throw the beast out the window. I guess their whole worry here is that the beast is going to destroy the Marauder and they're going to be trapped on this desolate planet, like isolated planet where no one knows where they are. But they're able to put the heart of the mountain back into it, which causes the machine to shut down. But the stone melts, because of course it does, and it triggers a self-destruct. So,
yeah,
you know.
So I found the ending of this episode to be entirely unsatisfying. Would you
yep.
agree with that?
Yep. I was like, oh, this thing's badass. Oh, nope, they just destroyed it, and that's it. That was just done. No explanation, no anything else, which, you know, the no explanation part I'm generally fine with, because it leaves it open-ended, you know, it leaves some mystery in there. But yeah, I was like, man, all of that for that. It's, I think we talked about this last week, but I was like, I had the same issue with the show Archer when they became drug dealers. But like, what I like to see, or I like to see people, they might be bumbling, they might mess something up, things might not go according to plan, but I like to see the main character succeeding. Even if things don't go according to plan, they still succeed. In this, they survive, But the actual mission itself is basically a failure. They come away with nothing.
Yeah.
You know, Fee lost her droid. The machine itself is destroyed. And even Tech remarks, he's like, oh, well, you know, we're 0 for 2 on treasure hunting, even though we had a professional this time, which I appreciated the little snide remark at Fee. But, you know, Omega and her eternal optimism is like, well, we at least proved the legend was true. Yeah. And I was like, I don't qualify that as a success, just the same way Tech doesn't. Yeah.
I felt like them going this direction with the ending just opened more questions in terms of, like, why would that be the way that it works? Rather than, I understand they're like, oh, we want to do this thing with this cool war machine, but we also don't want to, like, have to deal with the repercussions of this cool war machine running around. But I'm like, if you're going to do a cool war machine, then, like, do it. Like, don't just have it for 5 minutes and then, like, literally 5 minutes and then you destroy it. It just felt very, like, huge letdown. You know, like, I was like, okay, maybe they, like, will, like, some figure out how to, like, point it in another direction and then they escape and they're just like, well, let's never go back there. And they just leave it wandering the planet and, like, oh, and then we've got this cool loose thread that at some point somebody could pull on, and so, you know, some other story could revisit that planet.
Well, the war machine was a more interesting potential antagonist than, like, the tomb itself and stuff, right? Like, you know, I wasn't really interested in the booby traps and the puzzles and stuff, but the war machine was interesting, but then it's there and then it's gone. It was also more interesting than, like, the Fang Beast that attacked them. Like, the war machine would have been a fun thing if they had activated that early in the episode. You know, it kind of felt to me like, I know how long the episodes are, but it kind of felt to me like the war machine came alive and I was like, ah, here we go. Like, here's the reason we were here. And then, like you said, 5 minutes later, it's done and gone. And that's all over. And I was like, oh, well, that was anticlimactic.
Yeah, it's the thing that it reminds me of is, you know, the old Tobey Maguire Spider-Man series, Spider-Man 3, where they had, like, a bunch of advertising in that, like, for that movie around, like, Venom being a villain.
Venom, yeah.
And then, like,
with Topher Grace,
we get like literally 2 minutes of Venom being a villain in the entire movie. It turns out it's actually all about Sandman, and, like, it's just, like, not, it was just like, just, you know, sell me what it is that you want to give me. Don't sell me one thing, give me another.
Right.
And I just felt like, you know, they were, like, building up that there was going to be something big here and, like, it was going to be interesting. And, like, then it was interesting and then they immediately took it away. It's just like, but, you know, at the very least, like, you know, if they had, like, yanked the crystal up and, like, the machine had collapsed, but they had gotten away with the crystal, then it would have been like, well, at least they got something. Maybe they can't prove, right, you know, the rest of it happened, but they've got, like, a story and a crystal to back it up. I don't know. It was just a huge letdown for me.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's the show. I guess Fee claims that she's got a lead on another legendary chalice that she's going to go after. And, of course, Omega is enthralled by that. But they fly out on the Marauder and we're back to the status quo. So for this episode, I think I gave Faster a 6. I think for this one, for me, it's elevated a little bit. I thought the Ancient War Machine was cool. I like the Indiana Jones style adventure. I don't really necessarily like how they handled it. I think 6.5 for this one is where I'm going to have to land, because, like, I can't give it a 7. I can't do that. It wasn't that good of an episode. But, I, you know, like I said, I enjoy the adventure. I like the references that it was trying to do, you know, that it was trying to make. But it just kind of fell a little flat to me.
Yeah, like, I want to give it a 7, if I'm being honest. I that's the number that like first pops in for me, but the ending is just such a letdown, the way they just totally close off any possible revisiting of this story, that I'm gonna agree with you, and I'm gonna come down from my gut feeling. I'm gonna say 6.5 is fair, because just This episode was all potential.
All potential, all unrealized, unfortunately. But the next episode, Tribe, is much better. I would not say it is a great episode. It's still I think we talked about this too. I had higher hopes when I found out what the episode was about. I had higher hopes for it than it actually ended up. You know, what I was actually given, I was the tiniest bit disappointed because I was like, holy shit, we got Wookiees, we got Gungi, the Wookiee from the Clone Wars. We obviously see him, he's a Padawan. Then it's the episode where they're all trying to find their Kyber crystals, yeah. Right? So I was like, we got Wookiees, we got Kashyyyk, we got a Jedi, you know, we got an old Padawan who somehow managed to survive the Purge. I was like, I am about this. I have high hopes for this episode. It was a fine episode. I'd go so far. I don't necessarily want to say it was a good episode. It was an average to above average episode. This thankfully was the turning point where I feel like the Bad Batch kind of realized that like they couldn't just like pretend like the universe was normal. I feel like the writers realized that at the same time the characters in the story realized that like this whole we're just trying to go off and do our own thing isn't working. Like it's not working for the characters because good people are getting hurt, and it's not working for the writers because like the story they're trying to tell just isn't interesting.
Yeah.
So I feel like this was a turning point for this season. And there's a lot of stuff to really like in it. And we start off pretty strong. We start off with the Bad Batch traveling to a space station run by the Vanguard Axis, which I don't know why, but number one, that name sounds sweet. And number two, I really liked that it was like a smuggling ring or like a crime syndicate that was all droids. I don't know why, but I vibed with that quite a bit. And because, you know, we've seen Black Sun and we've seen, you know, Crimson Dawn and we've seen, you know, the Pike Syndicate. Like we've seen these crime syndicates and we hadn't seen one that was all droids. And I don't know why, but I was just like, all right, yeah, I see this. I feel this.
Yeah.
I like it.
Yeah, it was really interesting. You kind of add that in because of the way that droids are so often sort of treated in the Star Wars universe, where they're treated as being sentient, but then they're also like treated as second class. It maybe third class would be more accurate, like third class citizens. Like they're barely not even really like above slaves, essentially. And so they exist in this weird space where they're like not really alive, but they're sort of alive. And there's a ton of story space to explore there. You know, like, should we be on the side of droid rights or should we be like, no, these are not truly alive. They're not, you know, they are just machines. You know, where do we go from there? And that's not anything that gets explored in this episode. But I feel like there's so much story space to explore with droids if it's handled in a way that's more interesting than some of the droid episodes have been handled in the past. But anyways, for now, what we get is some droids have decided they've had enough of fleshy law and order, and they have their own crime syndicate, and it's pretty excellent. So
there's the droid leader is creatively named Axis Leader.
Yes,
which I don't know why, but I also even like that. So I was like, all right, that's
Cobra
cool.
Commander.
Kind of a sweet name. Yeah. He wants to check the authenticity of these forged chain codes that Tech has made. You know, Tech vouches for his work, and like the droid gives him a look and is like, your word is meaningless. Check all of them. Which I was like, all right, they're moderately competent. I would like to see these droids become a longer term adversary, yeah, to the Bad Batch. Because I actually was very intrigued by the story, but their story is just kind of a little bit of a false flag. Like we're, you know, or a red herring. Like we're led to believe that the droids are going to be the bad guys in this, but they're not. They get dealt with pretty quickly. So Omega and Echo are kind of waiting at the ship while Wrecker, Tech, and Hunter are doing the transaction. And Omega, you know, basically is saying, yeah, I got a bad feeling about this. I don't like it here. I don't think I'm not comfortable here. And Echo's like, I believe you are correct, and starts prepping the ship for departure, which is a good thing. But Omega hears, you know, a rookie roar, and of course, being Omega, has to go off by herself with her little bowcaster to investigate. She sees the two droids basically beating a Wookiee, and she protests, and the droids basically tell her to F off and get away. But the distraction lets the Wookiee kind of break free, and Omega, being the good-hearted person that she is, immediately assumes the Wookiee is the good guy and not a bloodthirsty savage that these droids were trying to protect mankind from. Right. And so she shoots the other droid.
Yeah. She's like, you know, I'm not having this. The Wookiee is gracious, as we can gather from body language. Wookiee stories are always tough for because, you know, since they can only speak Wookiee, I feel like it's a lot more of a challenge for the writers to communicate with them. But anyways, the two of them,
they're the original group, yeah. Right?
That's actually a good comparison.
And their language is called Shriwook.
There we go.
Yeah, Shriwook. Shriwook? And that's how that's pronounced.
I don't know. It's probably a little different and pronounced in the native tongue, but I'm not going to attempt. I have a terrible Wookiee impression, so we're not going to go there. But the two flee as more droids arrive to investigate the disturbance. They're hiding behind some of the mini cargo boxes in this station. One of the droids corners Omega, but the Wookiee takes it out. And then the Wookiee starts searching through a box. Omega's like asking him, you know, what are you doing? We need to go. Echo shows up then. And there's a brief sort of, you know, bit of tension. The Wookiee sees the clone trooper as a threat, which is meaningful, although we don't know why yet. And Omega convinces him that it's okay. Meanwhile, Axis Leader, which you're right is a phenomenal name, suspends his negotiations with Hunter and the other clones because, of course, you know, they are actually competent criminals and they have an alarm that's gone off. Like, somebody has raised the alarm already. Tech quickly and correctly surmises that Omega and Echo are probably involved in whatever has caused the alarm. And moments later, Echo contacts Hunter, asking for backup. Axis Leader and the droids confront Omega, Echo, and the Wookiee kid, who have basically barricaded themselves behind some crates. And there's a bit of a standoff. Hunter and the other clones show up, encircle the droids from behind, and, you know, then Axis Leader is saying, you need to leave, this Wookiee is our property, but Omega is not going to do that. You know, again...
Yeah, she said, well, they're going to hurt him or they're going to kill him, and Axis Leader is like, oh no, actually he's far more valuable to our buyer alive.
Yeah. and that pretty much... you know, sums up the way that the rest of the conversation goes. Hunter is like, you know, you can't be smuggling living beings. The droid leader's just like, what are you going to do about it? And then we find out the Wookiee uses the Force to retrieve his lightsaber from Axis Leader's belt. And thus we learn both what he was looking for and also why he was afraid of a clone. The Wookiee activates the lightsaber and attacks the droids, resulting in a firefight, which initially goes badly for the droids, as the Bad Batch quickly dispatches their initial opposition and heads for the ship. But there are a lot of these Vanguard Axis droids, so the Bad Batch does not stick around.
Yeah, it's a fine scene. I mean, it got confirmation. I don't think that anybody was surprised that the Wookiee was a Jedi,
yeah.
Right? Like, I don't think that there was a single question in my mind upon seeing the Wookiee that this is the direction the story was going to go. But I'm sure for those who you know, who haven't seen that episode of the Clone Wars and don't know who Gungi is, I guess that there is probably a potential for some surprise there, which is nice. They escape, of course, and there is a nice little scene where the Wookiee is kind of like isolating himself away from the clones, and you know, you recognize that, like, why would this Wookiee trust clones? Like, he had a terrible experience with them during the Jedi Purge. But Hunter, you know, reassures the Wookiee that we're not like the other clones. We didn't follow Order 66. We don't serve the Galactic Empire, which I guess helps to loosen up the Wookiee's trepidation, and he helps himself to some food. And this is when we get actual confirmation about the name of the Wookiee, that it is Gungi. But of course, this is something that I feel like everybody who had seen Clone Wars already knew. I think a lot of people wanted Gungi to survive, but we didn't have confirmation of it until this point.
I'll be honest. It wasn't my first thought, but it had been a while since I had seen that episode. But yeah, as soon as he pulls the lightsaber, I'm like, oh, okay. I got it now. Now I'm caught up. But yeah, so we learned that Gungi was trying to return to Kashyyyk after Order 66, but was captured by the smuggling droids. Omega suggests that they help him, you know, they take him back to Kashyyyk, which Wrecker immediately agrees with. Like, it's kind of as usual. He's like, oh, we haven't been to Kashyyyk for a while, which is
a nice reference to the fact that this story was originally supposed to be a Clone Wars story. There was a whole Kashyyyk arc that was planned out for the Clone Wars, and unfortunately, those seasons never came to fruition, so we didn't get it. So they took a lot of stuff from that arc and reused it in this episode.
Yeah, also the same writer who had worked on that unfinished arc, the writer for this episode, Matt Mishnevitz. I'm not even going to try beyond that. So got a second shot to bring that story to life and succeeded. And then we've got... you know, Echo providing a bit of a reasonable caution here. They're saying, you know, he's like, well, the Empire could be there already. And, you know, Hunter, of course, adds in that Jedi aren't safe anywhere, which is something I don't think that Gungi really needs to be told. I think he's sort of figured that out at this point, but. It's probably a good reminder for the rest of them who haven't had to think about Jedi problems for a while. Nonetheless, they decide to head to Kashyyyk, and so they fly off. Their plan is just to take Gungi to a village and hope that, you know, the local Wookiees take him in and provide him with shelter and protection. However... that plan is very quickly derailed. Echo detects smoke and deforestation on the planet and around the area where they were looking to go. The clones land the ship in a clearing, and they sort of start heading off to see what's going on. Omega learns from Gungi that, you know, because, and this is old hat to Star Wars fans, but news to Omega, the Jedi are taken very young, and so Gungi has no actual memories of Kashyyyk, just he's dreamed about the planet essentially and being a Jedi. Of course, his dreams are probably more or less true, but doesn't actually know anything about how to be a Wookiee on Kashyyyk, or, you know, what it means to be a all that cultural knowledge and knowledge of the planet he just doesn't have. Which, I guess, sort of pays off immediately because they very quickly walk into a netcaster's nest. Netcasters are a local large variety of web-making insectoids. Gungi, however, manages to convince the netcasters that the clones are not a threat, and the netcasters back away, and they're able to get passage through their territory.
Kind of interesting, because the original idea of Masters was not that they were going to be, like, sentient enough to allow, you know, the Wookiee to communicate with them. And the original episode, which this was shown back in Celebration Anaheim in 2015, the creatures themselves attacked the Wookiees and Clone Force 99, and they were shown to be aggressive and primitive, and they were all killed. So a little bit of a change there, but the creature design was originally based on what's called the Kenraths, which are from Star Wars Knights of the Old Republic.
Which I specifically remember fighting on Kashyyyk in that game.
Yeah. And then so they make mention of it that, you know, parts of the original Clone Wars story were reworked for this episode. And in this episode, the Netcasters only became hostile once they were provoked later on in the episode, and they actually fought alongside the Wookiees. So I guess he had a change of heart halfway through, and he decided in the original one he wanted to kill all the Netcasters, but in this one he wants them to be friendly to the Wookiees.
Interesting. Kind of an interesting change in the way that the story plays out. You know, but again, adapting it to the period that it's being told in. So they continue their journey, reach a valley ringed by mountainous peaks, and Tech is scanning as usual, and tells them that the village is close. They arrive at the village only to discover that the Empire has incinerated the entire village using tanks, which obviously kind of finishes derailing their original plan.
I did like the incinerator tank, though. I mean, that's pretty cool. Pretty cool little... I mean, I guess what is it? It's one of the, like, AAT tanks from the Clone Wars. But it has flamethrowers in place of laser cannons. I thought that was pretty fun. So I enjoyed that. You know, Gungi obviously grieves over the fact that the village is gone. But Omega's like, yeah, no, we lost our home too. It's not so bad. We'll help you find your people. Because, yeah, like, Kamino is destroyed. It's about the same thing. It kind of is, though. Kamino and Kashyyyk suffer similar fates. But they do discover several Trandoshans. And the Trandoshans also have a Wookiee hostage. And the commander of the Trandoshans is Babwa Venomor, which is actually a name that George Lucas came up with for the original Clone Wars arc. So that is some original George Lucas naming at work right there.
That's what makes it sound so classically Star Wars, you know? One of the Trandoshans informs Babwa that they have found some more carved stones, which Babwa orders them to destroy. The captive Wookiee attempts to protest, but is whipped into silence by his captors. Trandoshans, of course, love to hunt Wookiees. Not super shocking to find them here. I thought it was a nice twist that rather than fighting Imperials again, we get Trandoshans as our enemies here. Gungi, in an absolute fury, bursts out and confronts the Trandoshans directly with his lightsaber. It's perhaps the most ill-advised thing he could have done, but it does move the story along. He strikes down one of the Trandoshans, frees the Wookiee captive. The Bad Batch back his play, as they do. And pretty quickly, they've taken out a bunch of the Trandoshans in the tank. And Gungi takes down the tank's repulsor lift systems, while Hunter's busy taking out a second tank all by himself. And in pretty short order, the incinerator tanks are down, the Trandoshans are down or have fled, and things are starting to look like they're getting back on track in terms of, like, figuring out what's going on. The clones and Gungi work together to try and stop the flames that the Trandoshans have set from spreading by digging, essentially, fire stops, digging lines in the soil, stop the fire from spreading. A bunch of armed Wookiee warriors show up, riding something called a Mylea, which is more or less like a giant tree-climbing cat.
It's kind of cool. I'm about it a little bit. I like all the creatures that we're getting to see on Kashyyyk. Kashyyyk's such an interesting place to me. And like that's both partially why I like this episode and partially why I was a little bit disappointed with this episode. Is like I thought we were gonna get more Kashyyyk, more Wookiees, like more of that. And I'm not disappointed that we ended up with like the Trandoshans being the bad guys, because I also really enjoy the Trandoshans, right? But to me, like Kashyyyk is such an iconic place that I feel like if you're going to go back to Kashyyyk, you got to reserve it for like a great, fantastic story that, you know, that tells a lot, that does a lot. And instead we kind of just get like some, you know, low level bad guys and like a reunion. And it was like, that was like the tiniest bit disappointing to me. Like I thought maybe the stakes were going to be higher, or the Empire was going to be there more personally than just via the Trandoshans, or like I expected more out of going back to Kashyyyk, right? Like, anytime you hear Kashyyyk, you think like, oh, okay, this is going to be, you know, this is a big thing, because we know the Empire did a lot there, really, really horrible stuff. But like, we know the Empire did a lot, so I was just expecting a little bit more out of this. But, you know, it is what it is. It's better than nothing.
Yeah. You know, I was hoping to get some of that world building in terms of, like, the Empire, like, coming in and cutting down trees and enslaving the Wookiees and, like, you know, maybe the Bad Batch in some small way sort of stemming the tide or freeing some. Or, you know, I felt like there are a number of ways they could go in terms of, like, tying the story into the larger universe. And they kind of just neatly sidestepped dealing with any of that.
Well, they even almost acknowledge it, because they see the lightsaber marks on the tank, right? So the Trandoshans have come back with a contingent of clone stormtroopers. They see the lightsaber marks on the tank, and I'm thinking, all right, here we go. He's going to call in that there's a Jedi here, and the Empire is going to descend like en masse, right? And this is going to be the thing that like sparks, you know, the entire enslavement of Kashyyyk, right? Instead, Venomor tells the clone officer, don't report that there's a Jedi, and then promises his followers 100 Wookiee pelts to whoever finds the Jedi instead, right? So he prevents, like, they actually actively stop the Empire as a whole from being more involved in the situation.
Yeah. They sort of acknowledge that, like, you know, the Empire is probably not letting the Trandoshans just run around with their tech entirely unsupervised, but then give them enough authority to delay any word of this getting out. And like, we don't know what, you know, the repercussions of this down the line might be, but it's definitely held off. So, you know, we back at the village, you know, we've got the chief Yana, you know, the Clone Force 99 sort of explains, you know, exactly what they did to Gungi. Like, hey, we're Republic soldiers. We don't support the Empire. Trying to help this kid out. We don't know who his family is. And obviously he's a Jedi, so that's kind of a problem as well. You guys want him. It's more or less the pitch. Like, and it seems like it's going to go well. Like, the Wookiees are just sort of, like, grateful that they're attempting to do right by them in a galaxy that more or less has not been overly kind to the Wookiees. They also get a bit of intel that the Empire has sort of been using the Trandoshans as intermediaries to essentially strip Kashyyyk of resources and drive the Wookiees deeper into the jungle. They also learn that there is a large convoy heading in their direction. I think if I recall right, the Wookiee chief actually says y'all should leave. Like, you don't want any part of our trouble.
Right.
But Echo's not about that. He's like, no, we're staying. We are not going to abandon you in the face of this threat, especially not now that we've probably made it worse. Hunter agrees, which sort of settles, you know, any further debate. Once Hunter kind of decides, he's pretty much silenced. So they get ready to make a plan. The Wookiees hold like a prayer ceremony, beneath the roots of one of their giant trees. A Rosher tree, if I'm saying that.
Yeah, I have no idea how it's pronounced. It's Wroshyr Rosher tree. Which the curio box that is holding, this is some deep trivia knowledge right here. In Maz Kanata's castle in the sequels, there's a box that is holding Luke Skywalker's lightsaber. Canonically, that was made from wood from one of these Wookiee trees, the Rosher trees. So it's the wood is supposedly like incredibly strong, and it's used for a lot of things on the planets. I mean I don't know how much they've actually explored this in like on screen canon, but they build their cities wrapped around the trunks of these trees. These trees are massive giant trees. Some of them are 1,000 feet high, and the Wookiee cities are kind of built around and in the trunks and branches of these trees. Kind of a little bit like Avatar, if you've seen that, the James Cameron movie. So kind of a little bit like that.
Yes, I have indeed. And I may offend some people. I have indeed regretted watching Avatar.
Really? You don't like Avatar?
I thought it was a very pretty waste of my time.
You don't like Space Pocahontas? It's a great movie. I loved it. It was one of the coolest movies that I've ever seen in terms of appearances. And I found the story to be simplistic but acceptable for what it was trying to do. It was a vehicle for the VFX, right? Yes. Like that's what it was. Like the story had to exist so James Cameron could make the prettiest film that the world had ever seen at that point in time.
Look, if you can't be bothered to name like your MacGuffin something beyond unobtainium, I can't be bothered to respect your plot.
I didn't think it was that bad.
It was offensively bad. But anyways, I don't even want to get into it.
I would disagree with you there. Look, I did not think it was offensively bad. There are certainly some offensively bad things, but I don't think Avatar is one of them.
That movie ended like so stupidly. That's all I have to say. Like the entire the movie was acceptable up until more or less the end.
You didn't like and him then becoming it was just his like, avatar from the tree.
All right. The way that movie really ended is that this spacefaring civilization was like, "Hey, we want to strip mine this planet." They're gonna fight back. Oh, really? With what? We're gonna just nuke them from orbit and then strip mine the planet.
Maybe nukes.
What are they
going
to grow a tree
now
up to orbit? It was. I can't even get past how it would have been like emotional and impactful if it had ended in tragedy, because up till that point the story was fundamentally the same story that was told in Dances with Wolves and Last Samurai and a dozen other, you know, versions of the same plot that, you know, essentially civilization comes in and, you know, encounters, you know, this pre-existing native culture, misunderstands it, spoils it, disrupts it, and ultimately destroys it. And something vital is lost in that interaction. But it fails to tell that story at all.
And so you're saying you would have appreciated it more if the Na'vi were wiped out entirely, their civilization decimated.
100%. It would have been a better
movie. Not just the men, but the women and the children, too. That would have been the type of movie that you wanted to see.
That would have been a better film on every level. 100%.
I don't know.
Look, Anakin was right. So anyways, back to...
He slaughtered them like animals? Is that what you're saying? So you side with the corporation in this. That's why you didn't like it. It's because you thought the corporation were the good guys the whole time, and you thought that you were disappointed to see them lose.
This is like, you know, when you're watching... The Boys and you think Homelander's the good guy.
Yeah. You wanted to bring peace and security to your galaxy, and these you know, blue-skinned natives are causing all kinds of issues.
Yeah. Look, I'm just saying, would have been a better film.
Uh-huh.
So, anyways, Rocher Trees. How many listeners did we just lose? I don't even know. Let's come back to that in an After Dark episode. The way we talk about it, at some point it's going to become a real show. But
mm-hmm.
We'll have our villain arc. So eventually, you know, they make a plan. The clone stormtroopers and the Trandoshans approach the village and get ambushed by the Bad Batch with explosives. Cobra Commander, Venomor, orders his troops to press the attack. The Wookiees riding their giant Mylea. Boy, I have a really hard time saying that word.
I have a hard time saying giant... everything that is in the Wookiee language.
That's true.
Shriwook or Rocher Trees or whatever. I can't seem to correctly pronounce any of this stuff. Or maybe I am pronouncing it correctly and it just seems incorrect.
Yeah. Hard to know. So they ride their giant cats out of the trees, ambushing the Imperials and the Trandoshans. The Bad Batch and the Wookiees try to drive the invaders into a large nest of the Netcaster creatures, which they more or less succeed in doing. During this skirmish, there are a bunch of clone troopers, Trandoshans, and Wookiees all gunned down. It's pretty standard Star Wars battle fare for these animated series, and you know it's definitely fun to watch. We've got Wookiees jumping onto tanks, Gungi, you know, flipping around with his lightsaber, cutting the cannon off a tank. Venomor pulls out a flamethrower, thinking, "Oh, you know, you've got a lightsaber. Well, block this, right?" Which honestly, why we don't see more flamethrowers used against Jedi, other media, I'm not sure. It is like a really good solution.
Can't block fire with a. You can block lightning with a lightsaber. You can block blasters with a lightsaber. Can't block fire with a lightsaber.
Although, you know, we have seen Jedi actually block explosions just using the Force.
They could block. Yeah, I was gonna say they could block it with the Force. They couldn't block it with a lightsaber. That's probably why.
Yeah. So, anyways, you know, Venomor ends up like burning one of his own troops in the process of attempting to get Gungi, who just keeps dodging around, luring him deeper into the jungle away from the battle. The Wookiees draw the Netcasters out, who charge out of their nest and sort of overwhelm the Trandoshans and Imperials in a bit of an Avatar-like pincer movement, I suppose. Meanwhile, we've got Babwa Venomor facing off against Gungi and Omega in the jungle, using his flamethrower to just light up everything. He is indiscriminate and lighting these woods up with flame, attempting to give them nowhere to flee from. Gungi leaps out and damages the flamethrower with his lightsaber. But before they can engage in a fight, three Netcasters come out of the woods and attack Venomor and just completely coat him in webs and drag him off to their nest. In a bit of a dark but well-deserved turn of events. And then, you know, everyone kind of comes back together. The clone stormtroopers have been defeated. The Trandoshans have been defeated. And everyone works together to put out the fire. And fortunately, by morning, they've been able to do that. I can only assume that the Wookiees have gotten pretty good at preventing forest fires. I'm just picturing a Smokey the Wookiee poster.
Yeah.
Says,
only Rawr. You can prevent forest fires.
Yeah. But it says it in Wookiee, so you know.
Yeah. So, long and short of it is, they get back to the village. Wrecker and Echo drink liquor with the Wookiee warriors, which is a nice little scene. Gungi and Omega are playing under a tree. Hunter's talking to Yana and is like, you know, the two of them are just kids. And they say that it's kind of a little bit on the nose here, but you know, they're always happy when one of them returns, in hopes that they will. And then Yana kind of says, like, I hope that someday you will find a new path, meaning right. the clones. Hunter says, you know, I hope the path is far away from war. But I was like, man, I also hope they find a new path. Yeah. I'm with you on that one, Yana. So, like, overall, I like this episode. I think it's a good episode. I enjoyed the episode. I thought it was sweet to go back to Kashyyyk. I thought it was awesome to see Gungi again. I love the Trandoshans. I expected... I'm trying to put it into words. Higher stakes is maybe what I'm thinking. Like, you're bringing a Jedi in here. We don't see many Jedi in Bad Batch. Yeah. You're bringing a Jedi in here. A Jedi that you know the Empire is hunting.
Right.
You're going back to Kashyyyk, which is a pivotal place that the Empire did everything in their power to squash it, right? Because the Wookiees were so strong and so powerful. I felt like there was going to be some higher stakes. I felt like there was going to be a larger climax, a bigger story being told. And instead, it ends up kind of just being like a relatively small story about, you know, a single Trandoshan who's crazy like all Trandoshans are, trying to hunt this Jedi, and a relatively small-scale skirmish, one single village, one single place, you know, one single detachment of the Empire's clone troopers. Like, it just... It felt a little small in scale to have used Kashyyyk for the location that all this was going on at, and to have brought Gungi back as a relatively important character. I had higher expectations than what ended up playing out.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I would like to see in, you know, a future season, I'd like to see them like maybe return to Kashyyyk, and you know, maybe like Gungi's like having to square off with an Inquisitor, but is like wildly undertrained and unprepared for that battle and needs help, you know, or maybe he gets captured by an Inquisitor and the Wookiees call the clones in to help. You know, I'd love to see, that's kind of the type of encounter I was hoping to see, like an Inquisitor hunting them through the trees on Kashyyyk, or you know, something involving, you know, the sort of like the Empire coming in and just like strip mining Kashyyyk for resources, because you know, like half the reason they're there is because Kashyyyk is like this vibrant natural world that's still, you know, many of its resources untapped. And the other half is that the Wookiees are super strong, super fast, super agile, and pretty smart as well. And so they just make like the perfect slaves for the Empire to build their war machine. And we didn't deal with any of that stuff. You know, like you said, it was very small scale. It felt very personal.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of like the Trandoshans are here to kind of carry on their vendetta against the Wookiees. And well, the Empire is sort of tangential.
When you think about it, a lot of times you save the coolest characters and the coolest settings for the coolest stories.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in this case, cool character, cool setting, story itself, it's just the Bad Batch facing off against some Trandoshans, right? Like that's an everyday episode for them. There's nothing special about that. There's no special bad guy. There's no special troopers. There's really no nothing. The stakes for them are just the same as they always are. Right. And so for me, it was like, look, if you're going to have the bad guy just be like a group of Trandoshans and some clone troopers, then like any story could have that be the bad guy. But if you're going to bring in a Jedi in Kashyyyk, I thought they were going to step up the other side of the story as well to meet them.
Right.
And they kind of didn't. Like I'm used to them saving the coolest characters and the coolest settings for the coolest confrontations, for the coolest stories, and that wasn't what ended up happening. That's why the episode disappointed me. Now that being said, it totally was a turning point for the series, and I find irony in the fact that the last lines of the episode are like, I hope you will find a new path, because at this point in time I was really hoping they would.
Yeah.
And this episode is the beginning of them kind of going on that new path. Like the next few episodes that come out really start changing things. We start to experience some character growth, stuff like that. So, you know, overall, in retrospect, I like this episode more. I watched it a second time before we went over this, And in retrospect, I like this episode more because I know it kicks off, was kind of like a change in Bad Batch's second season. But at the same time, I find it difficult to, like, I find it difficult to give it a high score as an episode on its own, because I was so disappointed in what ended up actually taking place.
Yeah. Yeah, I truly, like, how cool would it have been to see the Bad Batch face off against an Inquisitor? Right? Like, I feel like that's, like, a real, like, squared up fair fight, you know, or unfair fight sort of situation where, like, do they have the skills to take one down? Probably they do, depending on the circumstances. But is an Inquisitor, like, a legitimate threat where you, like, could believe, like, hey, like, one of them might die in this episode? Like, yeah, it's you know, it makes the stakes convincing. And because you're bringing in a Jedi youngling, it feels like this is what you should see, is an Inquisitor chasing down this Jedi youngling.
So if you told me that they were going to Kashyyyk and there was going to be a Jedi involved, and you asked me to guess where in the second season that episode would be, I would have said it'll either be the first episode or the last episode.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, it's that level of importance to do that stuff. I would not have said it's going to be a random throwaway episode in the middle of the season that overall ends up having, like, no effect on the wider story. If you told me, like, yeah, they're going to Kashyyyk and they find a Jedi and they fight side by side with the Jedi, I'd have been like, oh shit. Well, like, that's going to be the way it ends, right? Like, that's going to be their, like, we can't hide from the Empire anymore. You know, like, we've become part of something better. Or I would have thought that would have been at the beginning of the season, and the whole season afterwards would have been dealing with the repercussions of that. Instead, it's not. It's a tiny little small-scale skirmish that really, you know, at the end of the episode, what do? Return to the status quo. Not yeah. Entirely, because this time there's at least that, like, find a new path. But it's mostly return to the status quo. And so, yeah. Like, you know, love Kashyyyk, love Wookiees. Even enjoy the Trandoshans as a flavor of the week villain. But, like, it makes me think that this episode, which I feel like should have easily positioned itself at worst in, like, the mid-80s. Like, I struggle to even give it an 80. Like, a 75 kind of seems right for me. Like, you know, if you were to give it an 80 and I gave it a 75, I'd be totally happy with that because, you know, 7.75. But, like, I don't think I can give it an 80 because I've given other episodes an 80 that I liked more than this yeah. one, which deep in my soul hurts me, because I would never have guessed that a Kashyyyk Gungi episode would have ever scored anything less than an 80 in my book. But the stakes are just so low, and it's the whole story just to me is like, it, you know, it starts off high with Vanguard Axis, and then I feel like it, like, trends downwards. Like, it almost, the stakes almost get, like, lower as the story goes on. It was just, I hate to use this word, but it was, like, almost uninspired.
Yeah, it felt like they avoided every opportunity that they could, that they had to raise the stakes. Like, they, not even just avoided, but they, like, acknowledged and then chose not to go down the path of raising the stakes. Right? They had multiple opportunities to raise the stakes and ratchet up the tension. And they were like, actually, we're not going to do that. And we want to let you know that we could, but we're not going to. You know, and so it felt like some weird choices. And, you know, you never know what goes into the decision making behind the scenes, right? Maybe the writer wanted to bring an Inquisitor in and got told no and just didn't have a lot else to work with. And this is what we get. And I give it a 7.5.
Yeah. Yeah. Seems fair. You know, I would have expected, like, oh, maybe this is the thing that leads to the full on occupation of Kashyyyk, right?
Yeah.
Is like them bringing Gungi back causes unintended ripples, which focuses the Empire's attention on Kashyyyk and leads to the brutal occupation that we know ends up occurring.
Right.
And I'm like, oh, that's interesting, right?
Occupies Kashyyyk for, like, the next 25 years from this point. Like, things right. do not get better. There is a dark ending to this story, but we're not getting any of it.
And I'm like, how interesting is it if the Bad Batch tries to do the right thing, but because they've been, like, avoiding the Empire, like, this thing happens and they can't avoid it any longer. Like,
yeah,
they need, this is the trigger which pushes them to go head to head with the Empire, but it doesn't. It's just, you know, small flavor of the week story.
Yeah.
And that's that. And so, yeah, 75 seems about right to me. So, you know, not a strong stretch of episodes, which is a bit of a bummer. But it's not like the first six episodes of season two have been bad. I would argue that there has been like one bad episode, one below average episode, three average episodes, and a good one up to this point in time.
Yeah, I think that's pretty fair. You know, and for the most part, it's funny how closely we have been agreeing with IMDb for once, which we don't always do, but they were dead on with us. Entombed as 6.3, which I think is fair to pretty much.
What did they have faster at?
They actually had faster at a 6.6.
Oh, which, see. I'm surprised by that. I think it's rare that IMDb rates stuff higher than we do.
Yeah.
But I really think faster was probably my least favorite episode of the season.
Yeah. But going forward, like from here on out, I feel like there are a couple of episodes that are weaker. But for the most part, I think the rest of the season, we have more good episodes than we do weak episodes. Mm-hmm. This is pretty much the point at which it's like things stop kind of being boring for the most part. And I guess I shouldn't say boring. Things stop sort of being humdrum status quo, and they start saying, okay, let's dive into the plot. Let's bring the main characters into the plot. Although actually the first thing we're going to do next week is we're going to take a step back from the main characters and not really talk about the Bad Batch at all for the next episode.
A good world building. Yes. Very good world building.
Really brings us in, and then we'll return to the Bad Batch when they do get brought into that storyline in the episode following. So next week, I think we've got a great set with Clone Conspiracy and Truth and Consequences. I'm very excited, and I'm saying next week, but I think actually we might be giving next week a miss, so it might be 2 weeks before we get a chance to talk about those two. But yeah, but lots to look forward to with the rest of the Bad Batch. The episodes start their upward trend here, and there are some dips and bumps in the road along the way, but I think it all comes together really, really well.
Yeah, I agree with that. So, all right, well, cool. That's episodes 5 and 6 of season 2 done. Next week, we'll be back with some good episodes, honestly, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm excited to talk about those two. And to finally start what I feel like is the real plot of this season.
Yeah, episode 7 and 8 are really, really strong. I mean, it's another two-parter, right? It's like the mid-season, you know, it's the mid-season dual episode. It's really like 1-hour-long episode. But what have we said before? The Clone Conspiracy and Truth and Consequences. You know, if an episode has got cool-ass title,
yeah,
it's going to be good.
Yep. And so we'll get back to that in the next episode. Until then, may the force be with you.
And also with you.